I'm sure there are people asking why my name is Svan Marek Sprake Engels. My man come out Nederland, so I'm Svan in name and Swan in nature, unfortunately. So you're going to have to bear with the English. Hello. It's lovely to see you all. I'm very happy to be here. I have been very tired of people asking for a seat at the table for a very long time. It's been something that's, I think, probably been in every single conference and event I have spoken at for the last 15 years. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what I think about why we already kind of have everything we need to have a seat at the table as TA and people. So I've got a question. You can just shout anything. Who in your company is responsible for the biggest budget? CFO, okay. Any other answers? Marketing? So it's actually HR, it's people, people and talent. The reason for that is about 60% of companies spend every single month is people. It's the investment we're spending in people. It's by far and away the biggest line in my P&L. Comparatively, marketing is about 10%. So people operations in headcount alone is 60, and then you wanna layer on your benefits, your ATS, all the tools and systems you have, and your entire HR infrastructure, right? Your people infrastructure, your talent infrastructure, the beautiful advertisements you're making, the beautiful parties and events you're throwing culturally. Every single thing you're doing is rolling up under this massive budget called people and talent, right? It is the biggest investment your company is making every single month. And if you are heading up that department, you are the one responsible for optimizing that investment, you. That is a massive responsibility. Right? That is so much bigger than a service team that is there to cut costs. You are now responsible for the biggest investment your company makes every single day. Huge. So if you now know that 60% of your company spend is headcount, and you are part of the team responsible for optimizing this massive investment in your team, what do you do with that knowledge? What do you do with that power? That's a question that I want us to talk a little bit about today, right? So my name is Jessie Svan, as we said before. I'm currently the COO of a company called Whereby. I'm the author of this book that my publisher makes me put on every presentation I ever do, so I'm very sorry about this, called Built for People, and it's all about how to approach your people and talent function as you would a product function. I'm also the co-founder of a tool called Peerful, which is an automated performance calibration tool, and I'm an executive advisor and on the board of quite a few startups and scale-ups here in Europe, but I actually live in New York City. So I want to tell you a little bit about where I came from. My dad was a truck driver who didn't finish high school. He is an absolute legend. He is one of the nicest and funniest people I've ever met. He cracks me up. He truly made me who I am. But he always had this kind of impression he gave me ever since I was very young that you don't really have much choice what you do for a job, right? You just do what you're given. He got given truck driving, and now he's a truck driver, and he's 73, and he still drives trucks. That's what it is, right? And I was told that since I was a little girl, right? You pick a job, that's what you get, you don't have a lot of choice, and you stick with it, and you make the best of it, and you have a nice time on the weekends, right? So my first job, I graduated university, and I got given a HR graduate internship. So I took it. It's what everyone told me to do. I just graduated university. I was the first person in my family to do so. And I just thought, well, this is what everyone means, but you don't really have a choice. You just take what you're given and you make the best of it, right? So my first job, and I'm sure many of us can remember these times, my job was printing letters of offer, taking them to the head of talent, asking her to sign them, taking them back to my desk, putting them in an envelope, mailing them to people's houses, going collecting the mail from the mailroom, opening those letters of offer that have been countersigned, scanning them, emailing them to myself, uploading them onto PeopleSoft, and then clicking save. And I did that for 8 hours a day for almost 3 months. And I can remember one day where I sat at my desk and I thought, I have fucking killed it. This is the best job I'll ever have. Right? That was the best job I thought I was ever gonna have. Think about how much the world has changed since those days, how much our jobs have changed, right? And of course, now my opinion about work is completely different than it was back then. But I like thinking about little Jess sitting there scanning and emailing things to herself, loving her life, and what my impression of that job is now. So it's my opinion that every single company is building three products. You're building the company you're selling to your customers, the product you're selling to your customers. And that's obvious, right? If you're Harry's Razors, you're selling razors. It's Vodafone, it's phone packages. If you're selling anything that you're building for your customers, that's the obvious product, right? And you've got a whole team optimized, which you are optimizing the budget for, who is there to make that product amazing for your customers, right? Then you've got a financial instrument. If you are a public company, your financial instrument is shares for your shareholders, right? And that is a product. People buy and sell those on the open market. There's a whole market that exists for that. And your board and me in the role of CEO, COO, is there to optimize that product for investors, right? Or if you're a venture capital company, really you are going out and selling your company to venture capitalists as a financial instrument. We're gonna be a unicorn. We're gonna become $1 billion. We're gonna sell to Atlassian. All the things you tell them, right? That's a product you're selling. And the final product is our product. It is the employee experience. It is the product we are building, iterating on, and selling to people. And it exists within a marketplace. It is its own specific type of product. And all of us are building ones with different USPs, with different ideal customer profiles, with a complete different personality on a huge and thriving market, right? So I see myself as VP people, chief people, and now a COO, as the chief product officer of this employee experience that we are building. And I need to adopt a product mindset when doing that. It becomes a commercial job. I'm no longer a person that's there to make sure I limit spend in our people investment, 60% of our budget. I'm a person that's there to try and optimize the investment to make that product worth a huge amount of money. And the reason for that is because the better quality product you're building for your employees, the better employees you'll attract that suit your purpose, what you're trying to build as a company, which then means you're going to build a better product for your customers. Better product for your customers means better financials, means better investment. If you have better investment or a higher share price, you're going to attract what? Better people, because your company looks better out there on the market. This is an absolutely beautiful flywheel that all of these parts are as important as another. If you forget the human experience, the people experience part of this, you're building crap products and you've got crap investors. You've got a bad share price. Things are going bad. These things have to work together, right? It's a commercial role. So I've built this slightly too fiddly for one slide, but hopefully this gives us the idea. Product funnel. This is exactly the same as exists in the product management world. So at the very top, which we've already seen today in the previous presentation, actually, we have this nice little awareness funnel. I'm sure we've all seen and heard of an awareness funnel. The very, very top, you have employer branding, which is the same as product advertising, brand marketing. It's going out there into the world and making you feel a certain way, but not necessarily asking you to purchase immediately. Then you've got recruitment, which is just the same as an acquisition flow in a lot of products. So you've got the process of getting somebody to maybe like come onto a website, have a look around, they're looking at pricing, maybe they're going to talk to a salesperson, right? This is the same as what happens in the product management flow. Then you've got offer and acceptance, which is exactly the same as a purchasing decision. So we need to be thinking about this in the same metrics, the same way as a product team when they're thinking about how do we optimize the purchasing decision? How do we make sure people are really bought in, they're putting their credit card in, same as they're signing that letter of offer for us. Then you've got onboarding. And onboarding is obviously exactly the same. You want people to be super engaged from the day they arrive and you want them to stay in your team. It's the same in product management. If someone's being onboarded very effectively, they're much more likely to expand as a customer. Product managers know this. They know that the NRR, the net revenue retention of a customer, will increase the higher quality their onboarding is, the quicker their aha moment. And we innately know this too in people and talent, right? And then you have this whole funnel, right? This whole engagement cycle that exists. Every time a people team or a talent team launches new features or does something new to make the experience better, that's re-engaging people. That's getting people bought back into what you're doing, your product. Then there's this idea of promotion. No longer are we just promoting people. We're actually extracting more value from them. We are upselling them. We're expanding their capabilities and we're rewarding them in return. And then you've got this whole flow that happens over and over again until someone decides actually, I don't want to subscribe to this product anymore. I want to subscribe to a different product. I'm going to hand in my resignation. I'm going to churn, which means that your employees are deciding every single month, consciously or subconsciously, to subscribe to whatever it is that you are building for them. And if you start to think about your employee experience as a subscription product and learn from product management, all of a sudden your world becomes much more commercial. So when I started thinking this way and I started talking this way in my team, I started becoming really annoying. I started going in and asking a lot more why and a lot less how. So rather than say, how am I going to make this happen? Or how do I implement a new benefit system? I say, well, why are we doing that? What's the strategic reason that this is something that we should be doing in our business? And my founder would come to me and say, I want a snack wall. I'm like, well, why? Why do we want a snack wall? Because Google's doing it. Are we Google? Are we trying to attract the same people as Google? What's our USP? Who are the people we're trying to get in? And all of a sudden, my CEO is sitting there and saying, well, maybe actually that's a good point. Strategically, it doesn't make sense. What's the ROI? And we're having very commercial conversations about the product we're trying to build to increase our overall business value. I'm going to give another little analogy. I was speaking to a friend of mine. His name is Virgil. He runs a company called Figures in France, and it's also in the Netherlands. It's a great little compensation tool. We were talking about the idea of building what matters for your USP. So who are the ideal customers we're trying to bring into our team? Who are the ideal people that we believe will enhance our strategy? And how do we build for them? And he had this really interesting little analogy he shared, which is, if the gemeente wants to know how high quality the public transport is, they may send out a survey to everyone in the area. Everyone in the De Basia, here's a survey. Out of 10, how do you find the trams? Now, I'm going to say 10. I love the trams. I never catch them, though, do I? I ride my bike all the time, and I live in New York now. But I would, if I got that email, 10 out of 10. Love it. We have, in people and talent operations, a really bad habit of asking people who ride bikes what they think of trams, right? We need to start finding the people that ride trams, so the people that really get what we're trying to build, that love our product, that want to work for us, and that are aligned with the ideal type of business we're trying to build. So if we're building a e-commerce platform, we're not trying to attract PhDs from Cambridge. I'm sorry. I know there are a lot of CTOs probably that you've been speaking with that think they are. You're not. So we need to go and find the people that want to work for an e-commerce tool and ask them, what are you interested in? How can we make this company appealing to you so you would subscribe, so you would upsell? And then all of a sudden, you're having very different conversations about the why instead of the how, and then you can implement things that really drive outcomes on your business rather than just drive more busy work. So the maxims I try to live by and have lived by for several years now are two things. Maximize impact to the mission. So every single time I ask why, I'm trying to get to the bottom of like, what are we really trying to do here? First principles thinking. What are we trying to shift in our strategy? Are we trying to drive revenue? Are we trying to increase engagement? Are we trying to improve the revenue retention of our team? And the second one, more controversially, achieve everything through others. I don't like building people and talent teams that are then responsible for operating all of the machinery that we build. I think it's a very bad habit. And I think it's something that product managers rarely do. So what this means is if you're building, for example, a interview debrief system, people teams have a pretty bad habit of saying, the way it's going to work is we're going to set it up in the calendar, we're going to send it out to everyone, and then we're going to go walk around the office and say interview debrief time, and we grab everyone up and we get together and we send out the forms. No. What that becomes is we become admin. Because we have to be admin, because we built admin for ourselves, hoping that one day we'll have time to de-admin ourselves, but it's not gonna happen. We need to build things that optimize and mechanize the whole team that we have doing that work. And if the team can't do it, then we're building bad stuff, right? And if you take that mindset, which is the exact same mindset of a product managers don't build things. They explain how to build things for engineers, for UX designers, and they get outcomes. We need to be like that in people and talent. The last little thing that I think is very important is I've never really used to be a numbers person. I was very good at like anecdote. I kind of love telling stories and being silly, as you can probably tell. But I reached this point, I'm sure you've all heard of the Peter principle, right? The idea that people get promoted to their highest point of incompetence. Everyone gets promoted when they're doing a good job as a manager, and then you're doing a good job as a director and you get promoted again. And then before you know it, you're at this point where you're like, this person's actually not doing a very good job anymore, but it's just because we keep pushing them up and up until they start failing, and then they stay there, right? I believe it's a similar thing around the gut principle, is what I call it. It's the idea that you get promoted to the highest point that you can figure things out with your gut, and then eventually you need data. It's going to happen. And for some people, some very lucky people with a fantastic gut, that might be CEO, but I can tell you right now, it's not going to be all of you. There's a very high chance for you, as it was for me, that there's a ceiling that comes and you have to be a numbers person. And when I say be a numbers person, I mean really know your company numbers. I know every single number about my business. You want to know our EBITDA, our top customer, the top customer spend on a monthly basis, our biggest churn, our churning customers in 6 months' time. I know it. And the reason I know it is because if I want to have a conversation that's educated about what I'm doing in my team, I need to know everything about how that company's working. And I'm really disappointed now when I meet a fantastic chief people officer, a fantastic VP of talent, and I ask a question like, what's your EBITDA? And they say, oh, I don't know, you'd need to speak to finance about that one, actually. This is the most important metric probably for the majority of our companies. And if you do not know this, then I do not know how you're building a tool that really is based on good decision-making. It's very important. And then use that knowledge, use those facts you have to think commercially. So I now think in basically three lumps in people, right? I think about, first of all, impact, which is really just return on investment. What's the return on each person that's in our team on their in their current role, in their ability to increase value now, right? No changes. Then I've got development, which is really the same as net revenue retention. So it's how many people do we bring into our team that we expand in their roles beyond what we brought them in on, and we continue growing them in value? And then finally, which is my favorite, is talent, which is the employee customer acquisition costs or the employee acquisition cost to lifetime value ratio. So this is how much does it cost to hire somebody, retain them, fully loaded HR budget, everything, my salary, the whole lot, versus how much value each headcount brings over the course of their average tenure. And what that metric does is it gives me a really nice look into whether we're spending more than we're earning on a head-by-head basis. This is a way better metric than regrettable churn, because regrettable churn just tells you people are leaving. It's a lagging metric. It doesn't help. This is a forward-looking metric that can tell you we're planning on growing this much over the next 27 months. If we hit those targets, our ELCV to CAC ratio is going to be 3-to-1. We're making $3 off every dollar we spend, and next year it's going to be 4. That is a way better story to go to your board with than we're reducing regrettable churn by 3%. All right. The last little thing I'm going to put in here is that for the first couple of months of doing this, I was absolutely swimming. When I took the COO role, I took over finance, customer support, customer success, most of sales, all of legal, which I already had, and then business operations, right? I went from looking after legal, people, talent, and a bit of business ops to basically the entire company except for sales and product. I then was also was on the board of a couple of companies, and I started becoming more of an operative member of boards rather than just focused on people and talent. And at the beginning, I remember sitting there with my husband and saying, I have absolutely know what I'm doing. I feel like I'm going to die. I'm trying to learn all these new things, completely overwhelmed. Am I an idiot? And he was like, sometimes you're an idiot, but not right now. When you're growing, it hurts. That's the whole point of it, right? And if you're not going into meetings and feeling like a bit of adult sometimes because you're asking questions you don't understand, then you're probably not learning new things. So there are multiple times that when we start expanding into being more commercial, asking trickier questions, bumping into people and demanding them to give you clear answers about what your job needs to have to be successful, you're going to feel pain. People may say, no, I don't want to talk to you about the P&L. You're not in the finance team. We'll demand it. Try to figure out how you can make that happen. People may say, what do you mean you don't know what our EBITDA is? Shouldn't you already know this? Well, no, I didn't. I actually never thought to ask it. I didn't realize I needed to know it, right? These are the kinds of pains you're going to feel as you start expanding into this new commercial mindset. And it will hurt, and you'll feel a bit silly. And I did, and I still do most of the time. But one of the things I tell my team all the time that really helps them kind of guide is, what was the last thing we implemented which made things harder for our team, for the people team, for the ops team, for the finance team, but better overall for the company? And the reason I ask them this question is because if our ideal customers, if customers we thought were great customers of our product, kept asking for a new feature or something new that made their lives easier, we would never hear the product team say, no, sorry, the current way is better for reporting. It just would not happen. Our CEO would fire that product team. And honestly, we should probably be fired if that's our thinking too. All right, I'm going to wrap this last little bit of the story up and then talk a bit about what I think is going to happen in the future, then I'm done. So I think about my dad and him thinking that there's no choice in employment and how much the world has changed. It is a massively different landscape now. When I moved to London, I realized that it's a marketplace, just like any other marketplace. And if you want to stand out in that marketplace of culture, you have to have your own identity and attract amazing people. But what's amazing for you may not be amazing for somebody else. And then I start thinking about, well, what's next, right? There's so many things coming. We've got this whole new generation of people that have been brought up on the internet. We're trying to really approach the world in a brand new way. And I want to leave with one last little idea before I leave. That is the idea of the transformation economy. So for a very long time, we thought about products as being commodities, right? You had a coffee bean, you sold a coffee bean, very little extracted value there. Then you move up, you have a coffee bean, you turn it into a nice cup of coffee in your home. It's ground and you can make it yourself. Nice, it makes it slightly better and you can pay a bit more, you get a bigger margin. Then you go one level up, you go into a coffee shop and somebody pours you a delicious coffee and there's music playing. Oh my gosh, it's gorgeous, we love it. You feel like you belong there, you've got free Wi-Fi. This is where employment currently is. This idea of snack walls and beautiful benefits and you get to come and bring yourself to work every day and we've got values. The next stage beyond this experience economy is the idea of a transformation economy. And that is the idea that you are not only experiencing something great, you are changed by that product. So in having the cup of coffee, you all of a sudden have a psychedelic experience and a psychic comes out and tells you what your future is going to be. You grow as a person. You go home thinking, I need to go there every week. I'm a different person when I come home. That is what work needs to be. That is the type of product we need to try and strive to be building. If we're not striving for a transformational experience, then what we're doing is we're just selling coffee beans on the street. All right, that's it. I'm done. Thank you.